So, scary times we're in a bit with our third war theater with the attack on Libya, the hope that Muammar Gaddafi will stop killing his own people and some sanity can be restored to that part of the world, and with the ongoing problems they're having in Japan. And, we're just getting into the spring flooding season, and there's a lot of stuff going on. And this will be the time when a lot of people will turn to the Bible for solace. They'll find their favorite passages. They'll contemplate God, perhaps like last week in our conversation on Coast to Coast. They'll find a greater amount of peace by prayer and by meditation, regardless of whatever church, denomination, religion, whatever it is that they pursue. But would they feel the same way if those favorite passages of theirs had been forged before they were included in the Bible? That's the area of this new book from biblical scholar Bart Ehrman. We'll talk about forged. Just what is in the Bible that Bart Ehrman claims is 100% completely forged? It's controversial. It may even be explosive for some. You'll hear about it next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. Dr. Bart Ehrman, the Professor Bart Ehrman, who we've had on many times on Coast to Coast, was on my brain earlier this week on Coast to Coast, before we're thinking about Coast to Coast for this weekend. Good evening, Bart.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Nice to have you back again.
Thanks.
I was thinking about you because we had a guest on last week on Coast to Coast, a Dr. Newberg, Andrew Newberg, who wrote a book called "The How God Affects the Brain." And he's a radiologist and he's a neuroscientist, neuro researcher, and he's at the University of Pennsylvania, and he did something like 5,000 scans of people who are thinking about God. And they would do a scan before and then a scan afterward. They showed that, especially over prolonged periods of time, the brain develops new neural pathways. It reduces stress levels, that prayers and meditations about God, even amongst atheists and agnostics, create a greater sense of well-being and reduce stress hormones, which can lead to disease and early death. And I thought, that's such an interesting relationship to to religion. And I know that at one time you had been a conservative evangelical Christian until you started to study the classic languages and Semitic languages of the Bible, and you started to look deeper into the texts, and then you came to a place where you consider yourself agnostic to this still,
Yeah, that's
Bart?
right. Agnostic,
Okay.
yeah.
And he said that even agnostics who are thinking about God still get the same benefit from these neural pathways, that only people that don't do any thinking about it ever, even atheists who just think about their image of God, show a benefit in their brain, which I think is interesting. I thought I saw it. It made me think of you because I was both finishing his book and reading yours at the same
Yeah,
time.
well, then I guess I'm in good shape
You
because
are.
as an agnostic, I think about God all the time.
Right. I think you got to be the number one God-thinking agnostic in the country.
Yes, exactly. I probably am.
So your brain, the effect on your brain didn't change at all from when you switched from being an evangelical Christian, a professor, to an agnostic.
Yeah, probably not. Still got the same brain.
Yep, but the and who knows, it might have improved it. Maybe that's why you can write so many books.
Maybe so, yeah.
So the new book is so interesting, and you make the point at the beginning that for again, once more, for a lot of biblical scholars, the concepts of this book are not new, but for the layperson, much of this material may also not only be new, but it might be shocking and even maddening, because people don't like to use the F word when it comes to the Bible.
Well, that's right. And I mean, I think one of the differences from my other books that are for the popular audiences is that this book, well, for one thing, I mean, this book is based on more original research. It's not just popularizing things that other scholars have said, but the other thing is that scholars too are reluctant to say that parts of the Bible are forged, even though if you listen to what they're saying, that actually is what they're saying. It's just they don't like to use the F word either.
And the reason why they don't, they pull it right up to the edge of saying forged. Then really, instead of using forged, they use, you know, $10 words with lots of syllables in them.
Yeah, right. So what you do is instead of saying that a book is forged, you say that it's a pseudepigraphon.
Right.
Which sounds sophisticated and technical, but and scholars all the time will talk about pseudepigraphy and pseudepigrapha. But what a pseudepigraphon is, the literal meaning of the word pseudepigraphon, which they don't tell you, is it's a writing that is inscribed with a lie. So it's as bad as forged. It just people don't know what it means, and so it's okay to use it.
In this case, in the book Forged, you focus mostly on the New Testament. There's some references to the Hebrew Scriptures, but the bulk of this is on those books that are more recent. Why not more of the books of the Christian Old Testament, of the Hebrew Bible? Why not focus on those and the names that are commonly associated as the authors of those books?
Right. Well, yeah, one could do that. And it's important to understand what I mean by the term forged, which of course you know, but maybe some listeners don't. When I use the word forged, I'm talking about somebody who wrote a book and claimed to be a famous person, even though they were someone else. And so in the New Testament, you have letters that claim to be written by Paul, which almost certainly were not written by Paul, written by somebody who said he was Paul. And so you do get that phenomenon somewhat in the Old Testament in a few places. I mean, for example, the book of Ecclesiastes claims to be written by King Solomon, but scholars are sure that Solomon didn't write it. It was written many hundreds of years after Solomon was dead by somebody claiming to be Solomon. And so you get it there. You get it in the book of Daniel, which is claiming to be written by a prophet living in the 6th century BCE, when in fact it was written about 400 years later. So you do get the phenomenon some in the Old Testament, but the problem with the Old Testament is that most of the books don't, the authors themselves don't make any claims about themselves. So, for example, the book of Genesis doesn't claim to be written by Moses, so that when later people said it was written by Moses, it wasn't the author's fault.
Right.
And so I'm talking about books where the author is actually making a claim for himself.
And it goes out of his way to put data in the book to try to bolster the case that it was written by this famous person.
Well, that's right. I mean, this was a common technique of forgers in the ancient world, and it's still used by forgers today. You want your reader to think that you're the person you say you are. And so if you're claiming to be Peter, for example, and you're writing a book, Peter is Jesus' disciple, well, then you tell stories about how you and Jesus did things together, or you experienced things in Jesus' life, and that way your reader thinks that you really know what you're talking about, and that you must be the person you claim to be.
And this is more common in the New Testament. This is sort of unique to the New Testament that they don't have in the Old. They don't give. There's not a lot of. There aren't any examples in the Old Testament scripture where they are going out of their way to claim to be somewhere or to claim to be doing something.
Well, the only two examples out of the entire Old Testament are the two books I mentioned, Ecclesiastes and Daniel. Most of the other books are either anonymous, so the author didn't say who they were, or, they're written by, or they're related to people who probably had something to do with it, like the book of Amos. We don't know who Amos was, but, the author isn't trying to make you think that he's some famous person that he wasn't.
In this case, it may not have been written, actually physically written by Amos, but these could have been the oral traditions that were passed down. Amos kept saying these things. Amos kept saying them, and other people kept repeating what Amos said until somebody finally put pen to paper.
Yeah, that's right. And so the author isn't trying to convince you, that he's somebody famous. It's just somebody, probably some guy named Amos who was a prophet, and later some of his teachings were put down into this book.
But the actual writer is echoing Amos. So there's an attempt at sort of like how, my great-grandfather would have told a story that keeps getting passed down. And if I claimed the authorship of that story, that would actually be that would be kind of a forgery. If I claimed it to that I wrote it, it wouldn't be. If it was an oral, you know, history that was passed down and repeated the exact same way, and then I finally wrote it down, I really should put my great-grandfather's name to it, because it's really his story, not mine.
Well, yeah, it gets a little bit, you know, there's a lot of gray area. And so the thing is, if you had a famous grandfather, and suppose you wanted to convey some message that was your message, but you were nobody, but your grandfather was somebody, and you wrote a book and claimed to be your grandfather, that would be a forgery, because you'd be claiming to be somebody you weren't. It's a little bit different if your grandfather actually taught, you know, left some notes or something behind, and you published those claiming to be your grandfather. Well, you know, that's a little bit different from writing your own book claiming to be your grandfather.
But claiming to be, I would just, and this is why I'm making this point, we're talking with Bart Ehrman about the book Forged. We'll get into more specifics about the New Testament scripture here in just a second. But claiming to be and saying the story is by are two different things to me. So the reason why I say Amos, you mentioned the prophet Amos, if I'm the one who's actually writing down exactly what was said by Amos, or as it was repeated for two generations, and then finally I put it down on paper, I'm going to put down Amos. Amos said this. These are Amos's words. I'm just collecting them in a different form. And I think that's
right.
Different than saying, I'm Amos.
Yeah, that's right. And that is different from writing your own prophecies and claiming to be Amos.
Right. Because that's really what we start to see more of in the New Testament, as you claim in the book Forged. And I think most scholars would agree with you. To what degree, that may be a matter of debate. But that there are books in the particularly in the Christian part of the Bible, where the focus is on taking the name of somebody who had the reputation and the authority and attaching it to a personal agenda that had nothing to do with the original person.
Yeah, or, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, it either had nothing to do with it, or it ended up being an irrelevant thing. I mean, if you claim to be Peter, and it turns out you're talking about something that Peter might have talked about, I mean, the thing is, you have no way of knowing, because you know, you're living 40 years later or something, and you've got a message, and you want people to read your message, and so you say that you are Peter.
And so this is not, as you said, this isn't really not controversial among most scholars, the idea that many of the writings of, say, Peter or Paul are not actually the writings of Peter and Paul, and in fact may be contrary to what Peter or Paul would have said in their lifetime.
Right. So there's very little debate among scholars about a book like Second Peter in the New Testament, which claims to be written by Peter. The author says he was there to see Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. He was one of Jesus' companions. And but scholars are quite unified that whoever wrote Second Peter, it wasn't Peter. So that, you know, for scholars, that's not controversial. I think for people who don't know the scholarship, it sounds like a fairly bold claim. What scholars are reluctant to do is to call that a forgery, and that's what I'm trying to do in my book, is to show that, in fact, that is what it is. It's a forgery.
And the claim is, and this is what when I went through seminary, I heard this said a lot, is that this was a common technique, and that this was sort of like what they would have done in ancient Greece or Rome, where the author was writing in the school of somebody famous. And so it's not fair to call it a forgery, because by that standard, it really wasn't, there was nothing wrong about it at the time.
Right. That's what I learned in seminary, too. And one of the things I try to show in my book is that view is precisely wrong. That, in fact, we don't have evidence that this was widely practiced. I have to be clear about it. It was widely practiced, but it wasn't widely practiced and approved. In other words, there are a lot of things that happen a lot that are not widely approved. I mean, people cheat on their taxes all the time, but it doesn't mean that there's social approval of it. Or, you know, people have affairs and commit adultery all the time, but it doesn't mean that it's socially approved. And forgery is like that. It happened a lot, but it wasn't socially approved, and we don't have any evidence, or we have very, very, very little evidence that this happened in the philosophical schools and was an acceptable practice. It may have happened, but it wasn't acceptable.
And there are examples of people who were either exposed as a forger, or they were maybe even in a lighter sense of the word prosecuted for being a forger. But then there were also examples we can know or know for sure that there was a profit motive. Even before the Bible had been codified as we know it today, there was a profit motive for faking books of the Bible.
Profit is a good term for this. So that in the ancient Greek and Roman worlds, you have a lot of instances of forgery, which is one of the things I talk about in the book. And forgers would sometimes, in antiquity, claim to be a famous author so that they could get paid for their book. And so if a library, for example, is collecting the writings of Plato and is willing to pay gold for them, then, you know, a lot of treatises of Plato will start showing up because, people can make money off of it. And so that's one of the commonly, the widely attested motives for forgery in the ancient world. And one question I deal with in the book is whether that motive actually applies to the Christian stuff, because when libraries are collecting the writings of Plato, they're not collecting the writings of Paul, because
right.
Paul, of course, is not a famous author in the ancient world. He's just this Christian who had these ideas. And so there's a genuine question about whether Christian forgers were actually doing it for the money or if they had other reasons for doing what they did.
Well, I think it's easy to assume that if the people of the first and second century of the since Christ were exactly the same type of people that we are today, and I think we are. I don't think we've changed much. That if they had the same motives, if they were wired the same way that we're wired today, then a lot of people might have forged their letters and ascribed them to Paul in order to win an argument.
Yeah, I think that is the primary motive among the early Christians. I talk about maybe, I don't know, 8 or 9, 10 different motives widely in the Greek and Roman worlds, but this is it for the Christians. You're living in a situation 20 or 30 years after Paul, and you have a point of view that is controversial, and you don't have any authority, but because you're a nobody, but you write up your view and you write a letter embracing your point of view, and in order to get people to accept your point of view, you claim to be Paul, because people pay attention to Paul. And so it's in order to, as you say, it's in order mainly to win your argument.
Yeah, and to win your argument and to try to influence people, and perhaps even on the other side of that, maybe to raise your profile, even if you aren't the person that that is doing the writing. If you're the person who did the finding of that text, or you're the person who's a local, you've been making this argument locally, and suddenly a text shows up that bolsters your case, that makes you sound like you were the smart person who got it all along. Well, then you do, in the end, perhaps enjoy a cash benefit, or just kind of through the back door.
Well, that's right, and it actually comes down to very important issues. I mean, there are letters of Paul in the New Testament that that indicate that women are not allowed to participate in the actively in the church. They're not to speak, they're not to teach, they're not to exercise authority. Well, these books actually were not written by Paul. They're written by somebody later claiming to be Paul who had that point of view. And in order to make sure the women were silent, the author of 1 Timothy, claiming to be Paul, in Paul's name, says that women can't exercise any authority. So this is actually an important aspect of early Christianity, that these books, some of these books, like 1 Timothy, are actually not by Paul, but they're forged, and they represent a point of view that Paul didn't have.
I think that's whenever you say the F word, that's going to be very uncomfortable for a lot of people, because the idea that the Bible contains forgeries, even if they were well-intended forgeries, that's going to create some ripple effects when we get to the phone calls coming up later on this evening. And I'm all for taking the calls. I think you're making a fair claim. Why use a fancy academic term for it when we have a modern word that's much more simple, if only because it also has much more impact. The word is forged. Bart Ehrman's new book out about which books of the Bible are forged. We'll get into a little bit more of this too. When we talk about Revelation, you can't help but talk about the apocalypse these days with predictions that are coming in May and then maybe 2012 for other people about the book of Revelation. So we'll talk about whether or not that is a forgery or to degree that that is a forgery on the way. And then even if they are forgeries, can they contain truth? Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Ponet. The book is Forged, Bart Ehrman's new book. He's got a series of them, and we've interviewed him over the years. This is the book, though, that may make the biggest claim, or at least the one that that some people get to find very challenging. The Untold Story of Forgeries in the Bible, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. I just mentioned before the bottom of the hour that we would get to the book of Revelation coming up. I'm just reminded of that because every day when I drive home now, I drive past signs that say Christ is returning May 21st, 2011. And there are a lot of people who are buying into this, obviously, some people who are investing in it, or they wouldn't be able to afford to put up billboards everywhere. And so that brings us, in some cases, back to the book of Revelation, as a lot of people expect that there would be end times in their lifetime. And that's kind of a theme that runs through Forged by Bart Ehrman, writing in the name of God, one of the subtitles for the book, because there was both another apocalypse that almost made it into the Bible, which was considered to be forged, and a lot of people consider the apocalypse of John, the one that did make it into the Bible, to be forged.
Right. So the book of Revelation is an interesting example because the author claims to be somebody named John. And so people call it the apocalypse of John or the revelation of John. And my own view of this is that somebody named John actually wrote the book, but he's not John, the disciple of Jesus. This, again, is not a particularly revolutionary claim. This is something that scholars have argued for many, many centuries. Scholars have known that whoever wrote this wasn't the same person who wrote the Gospel of John, for example. But people today tend to think that this, in fact, is written by the disciple of Jesus, John, and they're wrong about that. This is a case where of a phenomenon that's a little bit different that I call homonymy, which is a word that people don't know because nobody uses it. But it means written by somebody with the same name as a famous person, and so that's the deal with the Book of Revelation: is that there was a famous person named John the son of Zebedee, but he almost certainly is not the person who wrote this book.
Well, I think what's important to mention then too is then does it lose its value as an apocalypse, as a prediction,
yeah,
right? And at the time, there were a lot of people that were looking at whether they included the apocalypse of John or the apocalypse of Peter or both, and they looked at apocalypse of John with a jaundiced eye. It's really one of the books that almost didn't make it into the Bible.
That's absolutely right. Into the 4th century, we have church fathers arguing about whether to accept the Apocalypse of John. And there were church fathers who were adamant that, in fact, it should not belong in the New Testament. It was the last book to be widely accepted as part of the New Testament, and the argument hinged on who wrote the thing. And finally, church fathers concluded that John, the son of Zebedee, wrote it. This is hundreds of years later. They didn't have any way really of knowing who wrote it, but they thought that John, the son of Zebedee, had written it, and he was one of the disciples, and so they included it. Well, they were wrong about that, because John, the son of Zebedee, did not write it, and so that creates, I think, a theological problem for a lot of Christians. If the Bible contains books that were accepted on false premises, what does that do? I mean, does it mean that the book should no longer be accepted as part of the scriptures or not? So, I don't get into that question in the book, and because I'm not arguing we should throw books out of the New Testament, but I do think that the author issue is important to recognize that here we have a book that was accepted as part of the New Testament because people thought it was written by somebody who, in fact, did not write it.
Well, and I think it's a fair thing, though, that in effect you touch on it, on the idea of which books are in and which ones are out on what basis. You can't help but wonder then, you know, how much stake have people put into the book of Revelation, that a book which was you could make an argument for was forged, although, as you say, more likely honestly written by a guy named John, and he never himself makes the claim. He never himself makes false claims.
Yeah, that's what I argue in the book, is that the author doesn't claim to be a famous person. It's only people living much later who said he was a famous person, and so that's a different thing. That's a different thing. And you know, you mentioned this other apocalypse, the Apocalypse of Peter. That's a book that almost did make it into the New Testament. There were people into the 4th, 5th century who thought it was part of the New Testament, and it is a forgery. It claims to be written by Peter, and in fact, it was not.
Okay, so good. That means then, doesn't it, that a lot of the church fathers were attuned to the idea of what was and what wasn't a forgery. It wasn't like they would let in anything. They were trying to discriminate, weren't they, between what they could prove to be forgeries for what they had on, you know, at their hands at the time, and you know what they were willing to accept as being valid.
That's right. This sounds like, you know, it may sound like this is something that scholars are doing today, but they've just invented this entire this way of proceeding. But in fact, in early Christianity, this is one of the things the church fathers argued about. Is the book of 1 Peter written by Peter or not? And you know, and some said yes, some said no. And this was a topic of conversation because they obviously did not want to include books in the New Testament that were forgeries.
So to their credit, I mean, they were conscientious about it. It wasn't like some people have claimed, and there's a lot of people that will talk, sort of make up stories about how the Bible was thrown together somewhat willy-nilly, and that effect wasn't the case. But it still doesn't mean that they didn't get a couple of curveballs past, you know, into the batter's box, right? I mean, there's a couple, and we know that from, as you mentioned, Paul, that of the majority of the things that are ascribed to Paul were not written by Paul. I'm almost impossible for maybe 6 of the 13 were not written by Paul, or 7 of the 13.
Six. So there are 13 letters that claim to be written by Paul, and scholars are pretty sure that 7 of them really were written by Paul, and so those are called the undisputed Pauline epistles. And the other 6, there are some debates about a few of them, but most scholars think Paul didn't write them. And in the early church, they had a lot more books that claimed to be written by Paul that were judged by the church fathers to be forgeries. But the problem was that one of the ways the church fathers made this kind of decision wasn't on the basis of some kind of careful linguistic analysis like modern scholars use. Often it was because church fathers didn't like the theology of a book. They thought that it stated views that they didn't agree with, and so they said, well, Paul obviously didn't write this because it has false views. But they judged what a false view was in light of what they themselves happened to believe.
Well, but in a way, I mean, what else did they have? I mean, right? I mean, if they were trying to do it, that may have been all that they had, was just, does this seem consistent with the Paul that we know? And their idea that Paul wouldn't have ever had a contradictory idea. I mean, I think it's the same criteria we're using now. We look at 1 Timothy, where Paul talks down the role of women, but in other places in the Bible, Paul talks up deaconesses and other people that were central to the evangelism of Jesus.
Well, that's right. That's how we know that these 6 letters that are disputed, that's how we know that Paul probably didn't write them, is because they do stand at odds with what Paul himself says somewhere else. And the church fathers were, of course, you're right. I mean, it was completely legitimate for them to use that kind of criterion. It's just that they didn't have the kinds of analytical tools that we have available to us today to make a definitive decision. And if they had a book that seemed to contradict their own points of view, then they concluded, well, an apostle could not have possibly written this.
Now, the problem with this, and for people that think, okay, well, this is just, you know, a bunch of theologians talking about the number of angels that can dance on the head of a pin, there are some real life consequences for these forgeries, or for at least for the validity that's given to some of these scriptures that doesn't that are falsely attributed to an apostle or somebody famous, and that when you elevate the writing of some person we don't know who it is to be the same as being a follower, like a direct follower, somebody that was in the presence of Jesus, then that elevates whatever it is that they claim in the writing to be truer than just some other schmo on the street. And that leads us to what I think we can say some fairly dire consequences for Jews over the years, is that some of these documents that are in the Bible that are falsely attributed to somebody like a disciple it lead directly to the persecution and death of millions of Jews over the years.
That's right. This really does have serious consequences. So, you know, an example of that sort of thing is that in the Gospels of the New Testament, you come to the Gospel of John, which is the last of the Gospels to be written, and it does say some very nasty things about the Jews. I mean, in John chapter 8, Jesus says that Jews are the children of the devil, as opposed to being the children of God. And obviously, somebody later reading that takes it quite seriously and casts aspersions on Jews. And it's thought, and that's because, you know, John is thought to be an inspired book. Now the Gospel of John is not what I would call a forgery, because the author doesn't claim to be John. It's written anonymously. But later people took this anonymous book and said it was written by Jesus' own disciple who was there to hear these things being said. In fact, it wasn't written by somebody there who heard these things said. It was written by somebody living several decades later in a different country, speaking a different language, who's recording traditions that he's heard about Jesus. But there are all sorts of reasons for thinking that these traditions he's heard about Jesus are not historically accurate.
And so I think that's really the key claim then. Again, just to point out what you're saying about forged, is that they are falsely attributed, as I was making the point to say, to somebody famous, and that even that itself has consequences. Or you look at the number of women who were prevented from church leadership over the millennia just because on the basis of 1 Timothy, that wasn't really written by Paul, and that if Paul were alive today, he would see the line in there about how women should be silent in church, and he might have been absolutely aghast at that, but there was nothing he could do about it.
Well, that's right, because in Paul's own letter, 1 Corinthians, in chapter 11, he talks about, I mean, women do speak in church, and he approves of it. They can prophesy in church, and so that's okay. And it's more than okay. I mean, it was part of Paul's churches, but then somebody later writes a book claiming to be Paul, in which he silences women, and this is, we still live with this today. And the Catholic Church, of course, there can't be women priests. Well, it's largely because of this passage in 1 Timothy. Or in a lot of Protestant churches, women can't be pastors. Why not? Because of this passage in 1 Timothy. But it's a book that Paul didn't write.
And oddly enough, the person who wrote it very likely was a Gnostic Christian, not a mainstream Jewish Christian or even Gentile Christian of his day, but somebody who had kind of a radical view that sneaks that into the Bible.
Well, you know, when you claim to be somebody famous and you write your views and your views get accepted as that famous person, it completely changes how history remembers that person. And so that's why Paul goes down in history today for among people with a more kind of liberated point of view. Paul's looked upon as having these kind of misogynistic tendencies. And it's not really fair to Paul because he didn't have these tendencies. It's simply because somebody later claiming to be Paul wrote this book and then it got included in the New Testament.
But again, I mean, there are other examples of things that are, it's like the one voice got louder. So the voice of Timothy gets louder than other places that seem to contradict Timothy. And that's part of what leads to great biblical debates and what leads to denominationalism, because one group will elevate one passage over the other passage. But the fact is, it got in there.
And it got in there. And so what ended up happening is people would read the rest of Paul's letters through the lens provided by this letter. And so if you have this very clear statement that women cannot speak in church and can exercise no authority over a man and cannot teach, when you have that stated so clearly in 1 Timothy, then you think, well, that's what Paul thought. And so then you interpret the entire all of Paul's other writings in light of that very clear statement. So Paul seems to be opposed to women, but it's only because you're using this particular book, not written right by Paul, as a way of interpreting the rest.
You know, we see this to this day, and I'll mention an example I saw recently, and I know that you have others in the book Forged. There was an interesting documentary about Ronald Reagan right around the time of his the anniversaries that were being celebrated back in February, and there are a lot of politicians today who invoke the name of Ronald Reagan when they're trying to either gain popularity or try to get support for a particular idea, and in doing so, claim that if Ronald Reagan were alive today, he would agree with me on X and X, or that I am living the legacy of Ronald Reagan on the subject of Y. When you actually go back, and it's not that far, you don't have to go back but 25 years to go back and look at what Ronald Reagan actually said, and it would have been completely contradictory to what this person is claiming today, but nobody bothers to even go back and look at the source material. What would Reagan have thought? Because it's right there.
It's completely astounding. And, you know, it happens all the time in American history. I mean, where it happens even more, of course, is when people talk about the founding fathers, and they come up with all sorts of claims about the founding fathers that are absolutely false. But it is striking that this kind of activity can go on with somebody who is alive in our living memory. I mean, I was very much alive and conscious of what Ronald Reagan was doing, right. And yet here people just a couple of decades later can make these astounding claims. So it just shows that, in fact, you know, it shouldn't be thought that odd that people were doing this back in biblical times as well.
And they're naming the Ronald Reagans of their day. And using that as a way of backing up their claims. So why is it so hard to say forged then? I mean, if the evidence is so clear that, say, just again, to use from the Christian New Testament, 1 Timothy was not written by Paul, and yet the author makes claims that it was written by Paul, why aren't we comfortable just saying forged?
Well, it's a good question, and I wish I knew the answer. I think the deal is that we're talking about the Bible here, which is sacred scripture for Christians, and so even scholars who think that these books are pseudepigraphic are more willing to say they're pseudepigraphic than saying that they're forged. And it's because the word forgery has such negative connotations. And there's a tradition within scholarship that in the ancient world, this kind of activity didn't have negative connotations. And so what I try to show in my book is that view's wrong. I try to show that in the ancient world, they also thought of this kind of literary activity, where an author would claim to be someone famous, that they called that lying, and they thought it was deceitful, and they didn't accept it. And so I'm really in the book trying to make a case that the word forged is the appropriate word, because for us it connotes deception and lying, and that's exactly what ancient people thought about it.
And at the risk of doing the same misrepresentation of Ronald Reagan that some people are doing, and doing this in the name of church fathers, I would make the claim, I don't know how you would, that if certain church fathers were alive today and they looked at what we codified as the Bible and what we considered to be acceptable source material for what was included in the Bible, they might also say forged. Some of them would. Maybe not all of them, but some of them would be willing
to
go, that was forged.
So the ancient authors who talk about this phenomenon, of course, they weren't speaking English, so they didn't use the word forged. They had two words that they used for this kind of book, and the church fathers used these two words. One word for a book that is written by somebody claiming to be a famous person when he's not, one word they use for that is the Greek word pseudos, which is the word that means lie. And so they called these books lies. The other book, the other word is even more derogatory. They would call these books Nothaw. Well, the word Nothos means bastard. And so, you know, an illegitimate child, a bastard. And so they called these books lies and bastards. So they didn't approve of these things, and they didn't they didn't look the other way. They actually called them what they thought they were, which were nasty things. And I don't think that we should shy away from calling them what they are either.
Well, and there are more than just books of the Bible at stake here, too. I want to skip ahead to a later chapter in Forged and talk about some influential books in modern history which were proposed to be real, which were forged, but that some people to this day don't realize are forged. And they still quote them as though they were real, or they still quote the material that was in them as real. And to me, that's as vivid and as recent as a hugely popular book and movie. More on that coming up next with Bart Ehrman. Forged is his new book. And as usual, it has a beautiful, very lush, very cool illustration on the cover, too. All of his books are well done. Whether you agree with them or not, worth reading. We'll get to what we should know about other forged material next on Coast to Coast.